Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Eric Hernandez. Eric is a senior vice president and principal with Lee & Associates in Ontario. During Eric's career, he has worked individually and with a team of brokers within Lee & Associates, where the team achieved regional and national recognition within Lee & Associates and real estate community for the team's success. Eric has been involved in over $1 billion worth of commercial real estate transactions during his career and specialized in industrial real estate. Eric, we welcome you to our show today.
Bruce, always great to talk to you.
You know, our world is normally residential, and so you're our sole contact for the commercial world. And the last time we talked, it's been some time, you know, it was still in the tank, and that's probably not true anymore.
Quite the opposite. In fact, the pace of recovery in the commercial real estate world, I think, caught a lot of people off guard. You know, a lot of people were waiting on the sidelines and expecting a repeat of the 90s. And, you know, as we all know now, that certainly did not happen.
Which was kind of amazing, because the downturn that we had, say, 2006 and beyond for a while was way worse than the 90s. And so you would have thought the recovery would have been much more delayed and maybe much more gradual. But in the niche that you are an expert at, industrial, that has not been true.
No, there were very few properties that actually went back to the bank. And the properties that did were typically B and C properties. You know, the number of true A-class properties that went all the way back to the bank were very, very few, especially in our market here in the Inland Empire. And there were a handful of what I would describe as forced sales. Why does the market, you know, kind of hit the bottom? But the market was healthy enough, and those people were able to actually generate positive investment sales and very solid buyer interest in those properties based on the price points. And typically those were deals where maybe they had been funded by insurance companies or term type of financing, where they were unable to roll over their financing, and yet they were still able to find active buyers, maybe either all cash or pension funds, looking to deploy cash and looking for yield in a market, in a stock market that had really been beaten down hard.
Well, you know, what was interesting is one of the big fears was the resets. So you looked at the charts of all these billions of dollars of resets that were coming, and you thought, okay, well, I mean, that's really going to hit the fan. And basically, we're at the peak of those resets, and or have been for the last 2 or 3 years. And it's sort of like, so what?
You know, the timing of the resets and the, you know, just how the market went, it really, it's hard to imagine it having worked out any better if you were an owner of real estate facing that. Do you remember Sheila Bair?
Sure.
I don't know if you ever got to know her personally.
No.
You know, she was the chairperson of the FDIC.
Correct.
But there's a quote that she had that, like, if you had to go back and say, you know, how could you have maybe anticipated how the market might have gone in terms of real estate, both maybe commercial and residential? There was a great quote that she had, and I'm paraphrasing here. I'd have to go back and dig it up. But essentially, she was the one that came out very early on and said that their mission was to try to prevent a wholesale liquidation of real estate that happened in the 90s.
And there was,
you remember that quote?
Yeah, I do. And you know what?
Yeah.
There was very different margin that happened in the 90s. I was the buyer of properties constantly at auction at less than 50% of that current value. Forget the fact that it went down. The way they were marketed at the time, we were able to buy properties for 50% or less off of that day's value. And that did not happen this time.
No, no. And there was certainly a lot of, I know in your market, a lot of you know, homes that went all the way back, but it was, you know, on the commercial side, the wholesale liquidation of commercial real estate that happened in the 90s did not happen this time around. And you can go back and look at some of the signals and you know, guideposts, if you will. And that quote from Sheila Bair, I think the further in time we go forward, you can look back at that and go, wow, that they came out and said that's what their mission was, and they really did do that.
But, you know, on the other side of that, you have to have the demand. And the way they did it in, you know, residential real estate, it coincided with all-time low interest rates and then deciding not to foreclose on people that hadn't made a payment in 3 years. Mm-hmm. So was that replicated in the commercial world, or was it solved by demand?
It was probably both. There were many borrowers that were able to get, you know, the what we called the blend and extends at the time.
Blend and extend, okay.
Yeah, and so, what was it? There was an old quote, I forget who it was that had said it, but instead of mark to market, it was mark to fantasy,
yeah.
Right? Because everybody thought that, you know, things were going to get much worse, and they wound up not doing that. In fact, quite the opposite. And it turned out that there was a tremendous amount of cash that had been built up sitting on the sidelines. And a lot of these people, they have to deploy cash, especially a lot of these, you know, the teacher retirement funds now have become very active in the real estate world over the last 10 to 15 years. And their acquisitions people would come in and say, we want to buy these assets at these values. And everybody kind of looked around in the room and say, okay, and then the next quarter they'd come back and what do you got for us? And eventually they'd have to go back to their, you know, their people and they'd get asked the question, why haven't you bought anything? So, well, you told me that, you know, we needed to hit these guidelines and these yields. And what happened was everybody was looking for, you know, 8% cap rates. And they realized that everybody wanted to buy those deals, but no one was willing to sell at those prices. Because the sellers that were, holding on to assets wanted to buy more assets. And so the yield expectations got driven down. And once we got to a point where the yield expectations were low enough, meaning the prices were higher, you started to find willing sellers, people that actually were willing to sell at those prices. And we were off to the races.
Well, you, at a cap rate that's low enough, you also have a construction that's possible.
That's right. That's right.
And see, that hasn't happened in the residential world by and large in Riverside County, especially South Riverside County, because you still have the big boxed houses that they built by the ton going for below replacement cost. So that's very interesting that the commercial world, it seemed like it solved itself much quicker than I would have ever imagined. And I don't know if that's true in all product types, because, you know, when we say commercial real estate, that really covers a wide swath. And industrial real estate happens to be the niche that the Inland Empire specifically has done an extreme comeback on. Is that hold true in other product types like office?
So the people that I talk to on the, you know, the retail and the office side are all talking about, you know, the big price appreciation and the rental spikes they've finally seen and how difficult it is, again, to find quality space, especially on the office side, finding nice floor plate, you know, type office uses for the users that are out there. And, you know, that might not even be have been the case 2 years ago. You know, office and retail were really the last two sectors to come back. And if you had to rank them in terms of when they came back, you know, because of the financing component, and you would probably speak to this even better than I could, but the multifamily was really the first to bounce back because the financing was readily available for that.
Well, also, they knew they were going to have an occupant called a former house owner.
That's right. That's right. So they had plenty of tenants, and actually, from what I saw, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think apartments actually saw some nice rental growth even during the downturn.
Yeah, that was, the demand. You turn how many hundreds of thousands of people from homeowner to, well, what do I go into?
Yeah.
That was a natural transition that might unwind, you know, someday when they decide I'd really rather be a homeowner. But as of now, it's been a really good time for people that have rentals.
Yeah, that's right. So the multifamily and then industrial, bulk Class A industrial space, you know, the Inland Empire, if you didn't realize, is not only one of the best markets in Southern California from a from a just location and an investment and a logistics standpoint, but is really one of the top markets in the entire country.
Right. And I wouldn't know that because I'm not in the world of that, except for I read those reports. And one of the reports I read had the Inland Empire number one in the entire country. Mm-hmm. And I was just, you got to be kidding me. So because I really don't understand that. That's one of the things that, first of all, I'd like for you to tell me how an ABC classification comes about for industrial real estate. And then, yeah, what drove the occupancy or the demand for it? That's because our unemployment, our contractors and stuff, that's still not driving it. So I'd like to find out why it improved so much. But what's the difference between A, B, and C in the industrial world?
The big difference, if you're talking about buildings over 100,000 square feet, would be a Class A building would be typically a 30-foot minimum clear height inside the warehouse, and it would typically have an ESFR sprinkler system and typically would have a truck court deep enough to accommodate both loading and unloading of trailers and then an additional row to park 53-foot trailers. And typically that truck court today would be anywhere from 180 to 195 feet, depending on, you know, configuration of land. And especially with the amount of containers that come in from overseas now, a lot of these logistics companies, they have a need to not only be able to park the trailers that they're loading and unloading, but also have significant additional trailer parking to keep those containers on site until they are ready to be moved out.
Okay. And a B then?
A B would be, you know, in the Inland Empire, B buildings would typically be 24 to 26 foot clear, would have a shorter truck court. They would not have that additional row to park additional trailers. The truck court would typically be 120 to 135 feet. And then would have an older sprinkler system, maybe a .60 or below. And for some commodities, the sprinkler system in that calibration is fine, but for others, it's not. And so, you know, you ask the question of why was the Inland Empire, you know, one of the first to bounce back? You know, we have been a sub-market of the L.A. Basin for many, many years. You might remember, and you know, this was before I was even practicing real estate, but one of my mentors would tell me that people were afraid to come out here, and by people, I mean developers and investors, mm-hmm. to buy land and build out here because they didn't call it the Inland Empire, they called it the Endless Empire.
Okay.
Because there was vacant land, you know, as far as the eye could see. And some people thought that the city of industry would be kind of the eye of the hurricane, the center of it all. And obviously that's kind of leapfrogged.
Right. To what?
Miles out to
Ontario
here.
Or Mira Loma or.
That's right. That's right. And so one of the things that also drove this, I think this most recent wave of expansion was the tremendous improvement and advancement in technology and warehouse automation. So, for example, a company that was maybe in L.A., and then maybe they've got two or three facilities of, you know, a couple hundred thousand square feet or more, for them to take advantage of the latest technology and warehouse automation, a lot of times the existing older buildings in L.A., Orange County, either would not work or were very expensive. And so for them to even consider, say, a 500,000 to 700,000 square foot building, there weren't many choices in L.A., and they really had to look at new buildings to get the benefit of that technology and automation. And so for them to do that, they had to come out here.
Well, that seems like talk about a gutsy call. Let's spec build a 500,000 vacant building. That just scares the heck out of me.
It is the field of dreams. I mean, it has very much been, you know, this market out here is very often been, and if you build it, they will come. And it is a little bit of a futures market where, you know, when the market is going, you are buying land on the come, but that's the type of market that it's been for many, many years.
Who is the occupant? What do they do?
Well, a lot of those companies, you know, Amazon obviously has been a huge impact out here, and a lot of the children of Amazon and a lot of the e-commerce companies that have followed, you might have read about QVC making a recent agreement to build a million square foot plus facility right at Vineyard and the 10 Freeway, just on the north side of the Ontario Airport over there.
Wow.
On the old Meredith family land. And, you know, that's a, you know, it's a major announcement that got approved, you know, at the city level. And you've seen a lot of those types of companies continue to follow in. A lot of the companies that have done deals out here are expansions of existing companies that were also out here. Georgia Pacific recently announced that they had leased about a 1.6 million square foot facility in two buildings in Rancho Cucamonga. And that's an expansion for them. They've been in the market for quite some time. But a lot of these existing companies that have been out here, you know, a lot of it is organic growth. Some of it is consolidation from other locations across the country where it just makes sense to have more of that product here on the West Coast.
What has the journey been for land prices in industrial land? Where did it peak before, let's say, in 2005, 6, or 7? What was the bottom, and now where it's at? Where is it at now in comparison?
We're approaching the peaks for the land prices that we saw at the end of the last cycle. You know, probably the two or three best examples were Peace that the Di Tomaso family sold in Ontario to AMB, and then a piece in Chino that was bought that was an old Crown Coach facility in Chino. And those were, you know, land prices that are approached, depending on how you calculate, you know, net buildable area versus gross area on the land square footage, because there were some street dedications and things that needed to happen. But those prices were, you know, $21 to $23.50 a foot just on the land on a per square foot basis. And I've heard about a couple of deals that are under contract now that are approaching those prices again.
Okay. So it's almost all the way back. And obviously then the retail price of that product is also close to that?
On the rental side for those buildings, we're there. And it certainly feels like there's still room to go as far as the rental rate in terms of what landlords are able to charge for rent. And that's filtered down. You know, the big recovery out here was in big buildings for several years. And that rental growth has finally translated all the way down to the, you know, multi-tenant incubator, you know, 5,000 square foot user. And they were really the last to, you know, go to their landlord for renewal this year and find out that rents had popped 20 to 40% since the last time they leased a building.
Wow. You know, since I don't deal with that product, I just think that that's what industrial is that small space. Honest to goodness. You know, then in my head, it's that 2 to 5,000 square foot space, and there's a pile of those next to each other. I just think that's what industrial is. And now you're saying that a big bulk of that is just huge spaces for these big companies.
It's definitely several different segments of you know, the market out here. You know, the bulk industrial product is very different than, you know, the medium-sized business that might occupy, you know, buildings from 10 to 50,000 square feet, you know, plus or minus in that size range. Those would often be regional or headquarter-type facilities, maybe the only location that business may have. Often they could be partnerships or often family businesses, you know, that have a specialty or some type of value-add product or service that they're involved in. And the prices of that real estate has really, really taken off in the last couple of years as well. And now we're at the point now where I've got several clients looking for real estate, and we'll bid on a building and there'll be three offers on the building. And it can be very frustrating when maybe you think you've got a deal and you really don't have a deal until you're in escrow.
Yeah.
Until then, all bets are off.
What is the cost to construct per square foot something that's, you know, you pick the size and then cost to construct and then the value of it when it's done?
Well, so I always get myself in hot water when I talk about the cost of construction because there's so many variables. So what I'll typically do is I like to back into it. So you can take the value of the land and then you can plug that in, and then you can take the value of construction. And typically today, what I'll look at for my clients, because I get asked this a lot when they'll say, well, maybe we could just go buy land and then we'll build a building ourselves and save money.
Right.
And the difference with that is that you could buy land at today's prices.
Which is it roughly $1 million an acre?
Yes.
I just did a quick calculation. I went, oh my gosh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, 800 to a million, depending on, you know, a lot of times you've got to depend on or look at the required improvements. Is there any street dedication?
Right.
Are there utilities at the site? Do you have to bring anything in? How's the condition of the soil? You know, things like that. So what I'll do is I like to look at what people are building buildings for. And typically those guys, you know, the developers, they're going to try to sell for whatever the highest price is that they can get. And there's three contractors out here that, you know, you can typically call and get, you know, good gauge in terms of pricing. And if you talk to those three, you can get a pretty good sense of what that is. And the cost of construction for a 10,000 square foot building is very different than the cost to build a 100,000 square foot building. So if I throw prices around, they could be really meaningless because it just depends on what size of a building you're talking about. You know what I mean?
Are most of the buildings built on spec or built for a known user at some point?
The majority of the buildings out here are built on a spec basis.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's probably, sometimes people say that a deal was a build-to-suit, but if you really look at the definition of what a build-to-suit is, a true build-to-suit would be building a building when you've already got a tenant or an occupant ready to take that building. And often what happens is a building breaks ground, and then a tenant comes along and says, hey, I really like that building, but could you add a few more doors or add some additional office space and tweak this and tweak that after they've already broken ground? Remember, if they've broken ground already, they already have their construction loan. So the clock's ticking. A bank's already financed the deal.
Right.
That's not really a build-to-suit. That's I would call that a spec pre-lease is really what that is. And so, you know, if I had to armchair quarterback, and I would say that 98% of the deals out here right now are spec.
And
you can count on one or two hands the number of actual deals that are true build-to-suits.
And when they do this spec, they at this point have a pretty comfortable outcome. In other words, they feel like the outcome is pretty certain. Would that be the mood that they're in?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Like there are some users out there. Target's a good example. They often like to buy land and build their own buildings. And they built a really high-tech facility up in North Rialto, up off the 210 freeway in Alder, that I believe the parts of that building are as tall as 80 feet high. And
wow.
They have a specialized automation system in there that takes advantage of that height.
That's a fascinating thing when you talk about automation. You're talking about robotics?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because, you know, I've got some friends that are kind of right up on that, and I just didn't even know that world existed, you know, 3D printers, robotics, and now, you know, unoccupied vehicles. And one of the things that I've been told is, like, in the unoccupied vehicle category, the first that'll be occurring in is these big commercial trucks. So it'll be interesting to see how they work when they're unloading and things without a driver.
I toured, I'll leave the company nameless, but it was a, you know, large, well-known household name grocery company. And we toured their warehouse in LA last year. And the bulk of the warehouse was completely automated.
Yeah.
So in that type of operation, they are not just moving boxes at a time, but big pallets of goods at a time.
Eric, we're out of time. I want to come back to that, though, when we get back for our next segment, okay?
You bet.
We've been speaking with Eric Hernandez with Lee & Associates in Ontario. What's your phone number there, Eric?
909-373-2934.
All right, thanks.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.